Thank you, Tom, and thank you again for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. I certainly enjoyed the announcement last night in the plane, but I said 9 degrees Celsius. Right? I said, oh my God. But it wasn't that bad, it turned out. It was a very pleasant day, and as I said, I'm very happy to be here. So I want to talk about some recent results that I and my co-authors have worked on. That's Xiaowei Ding. He's a PhD student at Stanford. It's Eamon Arace, a former student. He now works for Barclays Capital in New York. It's Lisa Goldberg. She works for MSR Barra. Beho, student at Stanford, and Pascal, student at Cornell. And he's going to start at J.P. Morgan in a few weeks. So the topic is really multi-name credit risk or portfolio credit risk, and in particular, how do you price, hedge, and calibrate derivative securities, credit derivatives that allow investors to, you know, hedge against correlated defaults in portfolios of credit-sensitive securities such as bonds and credit swaps, or, you know, equity or any combinations of those securities. And the sort of approach that we would like to pursue here is called a top-down approach, and the idea is to view the problem of pricing, hedging, calibration through the lens of point processes, right? So what we are going to do is we are going to model the losses, the defaults that occur in a portfolio of names as a point process. And we are going to price these derivative securities really as contingent claims on that point process. And that's a kind of a little bit of a non-standard problem, because if you think of equity, classical equity derivatives modeling, then people are concerned with processes for their underlying stocks, bonds, rates, whatsoever, that at least have some diffusion component. And when we look at the credit world, and we are looking at the occurrences of defaults and the associated loss, then we are dealing with pure jump processes that don't have a diffusion component. And so that becomes really the problem of the derivatives pricing, where the underlying is a pure jump process. And I'm going to look at ways of constructing these point processes so that you get to a tractable, computationally tractable valuation problem, and at the same time have some economically intuitive dynamics for these losses. I'm going to motivate those dynamics. Okay, so let me start with my favorite picture here that shows for any given year between 1970 and today the number of defaults within that year. So left scale we have the number of defaults, and right scale we have the trading 12-month default rate, and they're both sort of moving around in sync. So blue is the number of defaults. And so what we are seeing here is pretty obvious. There is pretty much of a clustering effect across time. So defaults seem to happen in clusters over time. Now, of course, well, the reason for that is that defaults of different firms are not independent. They are correlated, right? And I want to emphasize two sources of that dependence in this talk. The first one is visible here in that picture. You have a cyclical component, right? All the firms in your portfolio, in your pool, in the anti-economy, they depend on common economic factors, right? And if these common economic factors, such as GDP growth, such as interest rates, such as commodity prices and so on, house prices, if they are fluctuating around randomly, then this leads to fluctuation in default rates. Of course, right, if the economy is expanding, then the default rates move in the other direction. If the economy is, you know, moving towards a recession, then default rates are going to move up. And this is pretty clearly visible in that chart here. There's a second source that is of second order importance compared with that cyclical correlation effect that I'll term feedback or contagion. And what we see over here on this chart, and it gives you some information about this contagion effect, is the price that you pay for getting protection on a portfolio of 100 North American crossover firms, crossover standing for double B, triple B, single B rated companies, or fairly risky companies, and you would like to obtain protection at any given time for 5 years on that portfolio of 100 names. And at this point, you would be paying 225 basis points. At this date, you would be paying, well, almost 225 basis points. At that point, you would be paying, you know, a huge amount more, I mean, 250 basis points. And what I would like to emphasize is that the price for protection on that pool of names is very sensitive to what actually happens to the names in and outside of the portfolio. Here, for example, we had a pretty tremendous loss event. Delphi filed for Chapter 11, and around the same time, GM announced huge quarterly three losses. And the effect is a pretty prominent effect here in the index spread and the price for protection. These spreads really jumped up from relatively low level to this high level and then reverted back to normal. So there is a sort of feedback effect to take into account here that reflects investors getting anxious once there is a significant credit event in the market. So there are two sources of dependence. The first is cyclical. Firms are sensitive to common economic factors. And second, there's contagion or feedback that leads to this kind of jumpy behavior of default rates and of spreads that we can witness in this chart here. Yeah? And when we build the model for credit derivatives, then we better take into account these two effects, for otherwise the models are not any good. For example, if you are trying to hedge correlated default risk, then if you are neglecting this sort of feedback effect, then your hedges tend to underestimate in a systematic way the risk and to fall possibly short of these events, yeah, if they occur. Okay. So there are lots of credit derivatives that provide some form of insurance against correlated default risk. They come in very many different forms. They target either directly the portfolio loss or they target the volatility of that portfolio loss. Right? Volatility, it would be an option on the on a tranche, an option on an index that would target the volatility of the loss. So, but what is common to all of those, and that's the perspective that we want to take in this talk, is that they're all more or less complicated contingent claims on the portfolio loss process L. So what's the portfolio loss process? A slightly more formal way of looking at it is that say, okay, there is some probability space that we fix with a filtration, and the defaults happen at stopping times that we denote T1, T2, and we have an increasing sequence of those stopping times, right? Now we can also look at the loss that occurs at, say, the kth default, and that's a random variable that we call LK, and we take the sum over all the losses that we've seen up until time T, we get the total losses in the portfolio, and if we move around the little T's, we are getting a stochastic process, we are getting a sequence of random variables that describe the loss due to default in my portfolio at any given time T. And that's the sort of key quantity in this talk. We are trying to, you know, model this loss process here directly and price derivatives, default contingent claims, on that loss process. So we're going to have to come up with models that are both economically reasonable, that take into account the cyclical behavior, and that take into account the contagion. At the same time, we ought to be able to price our derivatives on L in a computationally tractable way. Okay. Just to tell you that it's, you know, convince you that it's very easy to define the payoff profile of a derivative once you have agreed on the loss process being the key element, right? Now we are looking at a sequence of arrival times of defaults in my portfolio. So we fix a given scenario out of a sample space, and we look at the corresponding sequence of arrival times and the size. So that's a sample path of my loss process. The size of the jump here describes the financial loss that the portfolio experiences at this event. So this is the jump size describing the loss. So what does the protection seller in a so-called index swap pay? Well, the guy just pays up the jumps in that loss process. So if I'm going to value the cash flows at time zero today, that the guy is paying, well, then I'm just taking that amount and discount it back to time zero, take that amount, discount it back, add it to the first present value, add all the amounts, get the present value. So this is, this will tell you it's very easy to actually define the payoff profile for an index swap of which we have seen already the prices as a function of time t in this slide here. Well, not every investor is really interested in getting exposure to the entire pool, and so you might get the idea of trying to slice up the losses and get different risk profiles, different risk exposures. And if you do that, you're actually getting a tranche. So you can slice up the loss and give the slices different names. Equity is the most risky, mezzanine, senior, super senior. And the convention is that there's a lower attachment point and an upper attachment point, and the investor that sells protection on the tranche is going to pay whatever the loss is within the slice. So the total payout is limited by the size of the slice, the notional of the tranche, right? So you see already, well, the equity guy has the most riskiest piece because he's going to pay any loss right from the start. And for that guy, it really does matter how, you know, how clustered these arrival times are. If there's a cluster, so we have many arrival times happening in a relatively small time window early on, well, then the equity guy is going to be wiped out pretty early on, right? So that's a significant risk to have to take into account. And the higher you go up in the capital structure, the less risk the investor is taking, because it takes, you know, huge amount of defaults and losses before you got with your loss process into the super senior range, right? So for the investor that really wants huge return, high risk, that guy would buy the equity. The guy that wants to stay on the safe side buys the super senior. Yeah? And in between, we have classes of other securities that provide some trade-off between risk and return. Okay? And again, in order to get the present value of the loss that is covered by a protection seller, we would take that piece, discount it back to time zero, and sum all the pieces. Yeah? So what you will have observed already, if you are familiar with a little bit of option pricing theory, is that this payoff of the protection seller can actually be viewed as a call spread on the total portfolio loss. Why is that? Well, the protection seller isn't going to pay anything until the total portfolio loss has reached the lower attachment point. From that point on, the guy is going to take all the losses in a linear fashion up to the, you know, up to the slice notional, which is that point, right? So this is the slice notional. It's the maximal loss that the guy is going to pay, and from there, you know, from that point on, the next guy is going to take the losses. So I'm done. This guy is done. The tranche is completely wiped out. So what that is, it's a call spread. It's a portfolio of two calls, one long and one short, with that strike and this strike on the portfolio loss. So you can decompose, actually, slightly more formal, can decompose the payoff that the protection seller is going to make, so the cash flows that this guy is making, in terms of options on the portfolio loss. It strikes given by the lower and the upper attachment point. So if you now just apply an integration by parts on that, then you'll see you can decompose the present value of the default leg, i.e. everything that the investor is paying out in response to losses, in terms of the value of the call spread at time little t, and the sum of the values at time t of call spreads with different maturities. So we have decomposed really mathematically now the payoff to the tranche investor in terms of simple call options on the portfolio loss. Okay? So a similar thing for the premium leg. So I should say the tranche always consists of two counterparties. It's a bilateral over-the-counter transaction. There's one guy who is providing the insurance and the other guy who is taking the insurance and paying a fee, right? So there are two legs to that swap, the default leg and the premium leg. So what about the premium leg? Well, the value of those premiums at time t, they are actually not very simple, because they are also paid, the payments are proportional to the remaining notional of the tranche after default. So the guy who sells protection is suffering on two ends, right? Not only does the guy pay the losses, the guy also gets the notional paid on whatever is left after defaults, right? So with defaults happening, the premium notional becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, and so the premium itself, the dollar premium itself, becomes smaller and smaller, okay? So I discount that again. I'm getting, again, this as a portfolio of the values, so I multiply this in, the values of call spreads at various maturities. Okay? So the value of the tranche spread, the fair value of the tranche spread at time t, is nothing else than the solution S to that equation over here. So that S, that fair spread, is chosen so that I have equality between this present value and this present value. Okay? So that's the fair pricing principle for the swap, and we can get a theoretical model value for this, right? For this spread S, if we are able to price call options on the loss. So that's the basic building block that we have to deal with. And that's just an example that tells you, well, there is a way actually of decomposing complicated looking securities into much simpler building blocks that are options on the loss process. And trust me, there are other securities for which you can do a similar exercise, decompose the value into much simpler securities, that from now on we are going to attack only these simpler securities. So what's the approach that we are going to pursue? Well, we want to price an option on the loss process. So that's, we are financial engineers, right? So what we would do is we would model the loss process, that loss point process, directly as a stochastic point process, and then look for pricing an option on that process, right? And that's essentially the top-down approach. Specify the loss process, we look at call options on that loss. In this talk, we are going to emphasize the use of the characteristic function of the loss process to calculate the option price. We'll see that there's a large class of models here that we can specify for which we do know the characteristic function, and therefore we can price that call option here. In the second step, once we've achieved that and we have time in this talk, I'm going to talk about random thinning, which is a technique that sort of separates out the single name pieces, the portfolio constituent case pieces from this portfolio loss process. And that's important from a practical perspective, because you would like to hedge out the fluctuation in the value of your portfolio derivative due to fluctuation in the spreads, the risk level of the single names in your portfolio. For this, you need to link the L process, portfolio loss process, to the single names, to the constituents. Yeah? Okay, so now let me make that perhaps a little bit more formal and try to give you an idea on how to get the characteristic function for a very large class of point process, potential point process models. And in the second step, I will show you how to make this operational. Yeah? Third step, we are going to calibrate and actually work with market data and see how this all works. Okay, so we have the six probability space, we have a filtration, and okay, technical people, it satisfies the usual conditions, it's right, continuous, and complete. We have a sequence of stopping times, and those stopping times are the default times in our portfolio. Yeah? The first default time is after time zero, then my sequence here is strictly increasing, meaning I don't have any two defaults happening at the same time with probability one. And there's always some risk of an event. We're also going to assume that the expected value of the number of events nt at time t is going to be finite. That simplifies the math a little bit. And in particular, it implies the non-explosive property, which says that an infinite number of events cannot occur at a finite time. Or in other words, the limit point of my stopping time sequence is equal to infinity. Now, that's a standard assumption of non-explosiveness that we assume over here, and that certainly makes sense in the context of a financial model. So these are all very mild assumptions, and effectively these are the only assumptions that we are going to make. We're getting quite general results only with those assumptions. Okay. The first very fundamental observation is that the point process n is non-decreasing, so by construction it's a submartingale. And because of that, the Dubmier theorem tells us that we can decompose it into the sum of an increasing predictable process that starts at 0, A, and it's called the compensator, and a martingale, M, that also starts at 0. Two things I want to note is that there's a correspondence between the analytic properties of A and the probabilistic properties of the stopping times, in the sense that A has continuous path if and only if the default stopping times are totally inaccessible, meaning defaults happen totally out of the blue. You know, there's no way to predict them. There's no announcing sequence. Okay. Second notion that's often important is if the compensator is even smooth, it's absolutely continuous with respect to Lebesgue measure, and it has a density lambda that's positive and adapted, well, then that density process is called the intensity. And that's the usual starting point for many default risk models that people say, well, here's the process that the intensity follows. And what people then implicitly do is they specify the compensator of the point process. We'll show now that under the assumptions that we made so far, we can always find the characteristic function of the point process n in terms of the compensator. We will derive fairly simple formula that will serve us very well when we value these derivatives. Yeah? So that's the goal. Okay, and the first step towards this goal is to look at what I call a characteristic martingale. Okay, so we first define this piece here that turns out to be the characteristic exponent of the standard Poisson process, and we define a process V that's complex valued. It's the exponential of EY, EV, and V is a real number, times the value of the point process plus characteristic exponent times the compensator. Well, then it's a simple exercise to show that if A is actually continuous, that means all default stopping times are totally inaccessible. That's an assumption we are going to maintain. We can apply Stieglitz integration by parts. Stieglitz integration because this is a finite variation process, this is a finite variation process, so I don't have to use E2 calculus. I can work with Stieglitz integrals, and I can show that this Z process here effectively is a martingale. Why? Because I'm integrating here against the Dubmier martingale that comes from the Dubmier decomposition. Yeah? And effectively, that's another property of that martingale. It has expected value equal to 1. So why do I emphasize that? Well, I do that because we are later going to use this property in order to define a measure change. Okay. Before we do that, we look at the simplest process that we can, simplest point process model we can think of. We'll see how it fits in with this type of martingale argument. So suppose, again, A is continuous, totally inaccessible default times. And in addition to that, let's assume it's deterministic. Well, then you can just rewrite the martingale condition to get a formula immediately for the conditional characteristic function of that point process n. And it's equal to e to the minus the characteristic exponent times the increment in the compensator. And you use just the martingale property from the previous slide and the deterministic nature of the compensator. Okay? So suppose, just by looking at that, that obviously the process n has independent increments, and that the increment itself has the Poisson distribution. That's the characteristic function of the Poisson distribution with parameter given by the increment at the compensator, and of course we have the Poisson distribution popping right out. Okay? So that's a consistent martingale approach to a very fundamental point process, the Poisson process. Right? And now we are trying to upgrade this. We are trying to relax these assumptions here. So the next step is going to be, we'll allow A to be stochastic, but independent of the point process itself. Yeah? So that's the next thing. And when we do this, we are getting what is known as a doubly stochastic Poisson process. It's a very large class of potential models that has been very widely used in credit risk modeling and other applied fields. Why is that so? Well, it's very tractable, as we'll see. So A, continuous, stochastic, but independent of N. What does this mean? Well, you can roll the die once to get the compensator. Now you fix the path of the compensator, and you roll the die again to get the realizations of the points given the compensator. So there's a sort of two-step randomization involved here, and therefore this thing is called doubly stochastic. Yeah? And so we can always just condition, you know, on a realization of A, and we see that conditional on A, N is again just the Poisson process, so we can recover the characteristic function by simple iterated expectations, and we can write it, right? What is this here? Well, that's the Laplace transform of the compensator evaluated at the characteristic exponent of the Poisson process. Yeah, so this is my conditional Laplace transform, conditional because I've always taken conditional expectations, and well, that's what it is. So for the finance people among you, you recognize, what is this here? Well, that's like the bond price, the zero coupon bond price, if this is the cumulative short rate times U. So that we'll keep in the back of our heads in order to then later on derive models that lead to tractable formulas. Yeah? And again, by conditioning, of course, I can recover the complete conditional probabilities in terms of successive derivatives of the Laplace transform. So the thing is, I can assume this independence here, all right, get a tractable class of models, and they all become tractable once I know what the characteristic, what the conditional Laplace transform is of the compensator. Because then I just stick it in here and I get my characteristic function of the point process. So next step now is we want to relax this independence here. Why do we do this? Well, I said right at the beginning, look at this figure again. What we want to incorporate is feedback, right? We want to sort of take account of the fact that clustering comes from feedback, right? We see a couple of events, and that increases the likelihood of seeing even more events in the future. So we have the sort of build-up of the process. We have the self-referential feature, self-affecting feature. And in those cases, the compensator or the intensity itself is not independent anymore of the point process itself. And we'll see parametric examples of that in a minute. So in order to cover that situation, we have to relax the independence assumption. So again, we maintain the assumption of total inaccessible defaults, but we say that the compensator might depend on the point process itself, modeling event feedback. Okay? Now, we consider what I call a correlation neutral measure. What we do is we define a new probability measure, PV, that's indexed by a real number V, and the density with respect to our original reference measure, P, is given by our characteristic martingale that we played around with already in the two previous slides. Okay? And we showed that the expected value of that thing is actually equal to 1, so it's perfectly fine to define a new probability measure, PV, with that density. Okay? Well, once I have a new measure, I can, of course, also define a Laplace transform of my compensator under this new measure. Let's call that the same one. I just have an additional variable, V, floating around that refers to the measure under which I'm taking the expectation. And we are getting the usual P Laplace transform back if we substitute a 0 in for the V, because if I have 0 for the V, this drops out. This is 1 minus e to the IV. This is becoming 0, so the measure change actually doesn't do anything. PV is equal to P, and I'm recovering my original Laplace transform. Okay? Very important fact. I'm not going to go into this. There's a little work that you have to show that under this new measure, PV, the compensator of my point process that counts the defaults in the portfolio actually has compensator given by the original compensator 8 times e to the iv. So there's a very simple adjustment that I have to make once I go from the original measure to the new measure. So why do I have this new measure here? Well, it turns out by very simple calculations, I can rewrite the characteristic function of my point process again in terms of the Laplace transform evaluated at the characteristic exponent, but this time I have to do it under the correlation neutral measure. Right? And just to reiterate what the trick is this, right? In finance, we know we move from the physical probability to risk neutral probability in order to price a claim by simply discounting the expected payoff. Okay? And we are taking that expectation under the risk neutral measure. So if we were risk neutral, or put another way, if we put ourselves under this new risk neutral measure, we are risk neutral. And we do the same thing over here with the correlation neutral measure. If we place ourselves under this measure, then there's no correlation between the compensator and the point process itself, and therefore, I can get the same simple formula for the characteristic function of the point process as before. I just have to account for this little measure change. Yeah? Well, here we are in the unfortunate situation that we have to invert numerically this Laplace transform here or this characteristic function in order to get these probabilities. So it gets a little bit more complicated. I don't have this simple formula in the W stochastic case anymore where I just differentiate the Laplace transform. Yeah? So you see already, here we have the usual Laplace transform. Then I'm going to the next higher class of models where I have to change the measure, then calculate the Laplace transform, but still I can interpret this as a bond price. Well, but it's taken, the expectation is taken under some other measure. Okay, but this is all right because I know how to change the random quantity that I'm looking at under this new, how do I get there from the original measure P. Yeah? So this is all well defined. Okay, now an example here where we can actually do calculations that we have parameters that we can fit to market prices. And the class of processes is only one class of examples that we can generate within that framework, and they are called the affine point processes. So we are considering here point process N, and it has a compensator A that's absolutely continuous, and the density process lambda, that's the intensity, is an affine function with constants lambda naught, lambda 1 of a stochastic process X. It has the interpretation of a risk factor, and that risk factor follows a so-called affine jump diffusion. So there is a drift, there is a volatility, there's a Brownian motion that's independent of any other random quantity in our model, and there is the point process itself. Right? So we have here a random process that has a drift term, a diffusion term, and a jump term, and the jump term is the point process, is governed by the point process whose intensity we are modeling here itself. So we have explicitly gotten a self-referential, self-activating process whose intensity lambda depends on the process itself. So for the intensity is nothing else as the conditional arrival rate of events, and we are saying, well, that conditional arrival rate at time t depends on how many defaults we've observed in the past and at what times were these defaults. Yeah? And it's called an affine jump diffusion because the coefficient functions mu, sigma are just affine in the state, or the sigma squared, the instantaneous variance, are affine functions with constant coefficients in the state. Yeah? And I haven't displayed it here, but the obvious generalizations to a multiple dimension, so X could be vector, right? I could have time-dependent parameter functions, so I have here X comma little t, that's doable. I can have additional jump terms floating around here, all no problems. I haven't done it because I want to keep this denotation relatively light. Okay. So how do we now get our Laplace transform? We know all we need in order to get the characteristic function of the process is the Laplace transform under the new measure. Well, the new measure is not trivial because, as I said, we have correlation between the point process and its intensity. We get rid of it if we change the measure. So we have to calculate the Laplace transform of our compensator, which is now just the integrated intensity, right? That was our assumption under this measure V. But, you know, there's almost no work we have to do because we know what that expression is under the original measure P. The only thing that we have to adjust is the intensity. We know it's going to change from lambda to e to the iv times lambda. Okay? So this is all just affine jump diffusion, well-known stuff, and here we've changed, you know, the jump piece, that refers to the jump. We have multiplied these two pieces with e to the iv, and we've done already the adjustment that was necessary from going from p to p correlation neutral. Yeah? So this is standard affine jump diffusion stuff, Duffy-Penn-Singleton. The adjustment we have to make if we change the measure, because we have to calculate Laplace transform under this new measure, is we have to adjust the jump terms here. We have to adjust the intensity. Right? So this term appears here because we are changing the measure. So therefore, we have our Laplace transform as an exponential affine function in the current state of the risk factor, and the coefficient functions alpha and beta are given in terms of solutions of these two ODEs. So still, we would have to solve two ODEs just to get the characteristic function, right? Okay? So now let's look at two examples where we can actually, you know, see a little bit of what's going on. So the first example is the so-called Hawkes process. It's due to Hawkes, and there's a paper on 70-something where Hawkes looked first at these processes. But he wasn't able to establish any things like distribution or characteristic function. But here, these are very special results that pop out automatically, right? That's we are just choosing now all the parameters appropriately to end up with an intensity process that has this piece over here. So we have a drift term, you know, it's exponentially declining, and we have a feedback term here that has sensitivity parameter delta. So the kappa is the speed at which the intensity reverts back to lambda infinity after an event, and delta is the sensitivity of the intensity at an event. By how much does the intensity jump up at an event? Okay, of course, the well-known special cases of kappa and delta are zero, we recover the plain Poisson process. If kappa is equal to zero, this term drops out, we're getting the birth process. Yeah? So the Hawkes process, we start with Poisson, then we get birth, then we get a Hawkes process. Right? And we'll see we have more examples. We generalize this, you know, set of models even further. So we now get a very simple set of two ODEs that we still have to solve numerically. And that determines, these two ODEs determine my Laplace transform, okay, which in turn, if evaluated at the characteristic exponent, gives me the characteristic function, the conditional characteristic function of the Hawkes process. Now that I have the conditional characteristic function, well, you know, I have complete control over the conditional laws of the process, and I can, you know, calculate any quantity I'm interested in. In particular, I can calculate prices of options written on N. Yeah? Okay, so here's a simulated sample path of the Poisson process and the Hawkes process so that the expected number of events matches up over 30 years. Right? And you see, of course, the Poisson process, due to all the statistics property, very well spread out event arrivals, whereas for the Hawkes process, you see very interesting clustering effects. And now if you go back and say, well, how does this compare with the picture we saw over here, well, here there's clustering. A very heavy clustering, and I've proposed a very simple process, very few parameters, very parsimonious, that captures this kind of behavior already very nicely. Yeah? Look at that. We're looking at the number of events in a given year. That's the bar. We're getting heavy clustering, which is what we want, right? And there's no Brownian motion whatsoever involved. It's just that the process only moves stochastically at events at which time it jumps up. Yeah? Okay, so here's a sample path of the Hodge process itself with the associated loss process. So we start out with a constant intensity, say, well, that's the first arrival. Hodge process jumps up. It reverts back with speed kappa until the next event. Here's the next loss piece, jumps up, goes down until the next event, jumps up again, and so on. Yeah? So the next generalization that we will look at is, well, we want to make this random here. We want to have some random fluctuation. Yeah? So we introduce a Brownian term. Well, that's very simple, right? So we have a Brownian term here that shows up now in addition, square root. So it looks really like finance is the Cox-Engelsel-Russ process, but here's an additional term here that is self-referential because this is the intensity of that guy. Yeah? So it's a extended CIR type intensity process, if you like, and of course if the sigma is equal to zero, we would cover the Hawkes process. The ODEs are the same as before. We only have one additional term that relates to, or H1, that's the danger of copy and paste, H1 is equal to sigma square. Yeah? So this is sigma square. Okay, and again, I can recover my characteristic function. Okay, so this is how the sample path of the intensity, blue, and the sample path of the associated loss process it looks like. And you see you have slightly more interesting behavior because you have random fluctuation in between the event arrivals, right? Okay, now how can we calibrate that? Well, here's a simple calibration example. We took the same index that we had at the beginning. No, we have this time North American firms, high yield. It's a slightly different portfolio. 5 year. I think I said at the beginning that XO, the crossover, had 100 names. It has only 35 names. The high yield has 100 names. So we looked at the prices of those tranches and indices on December 8th last year, and we were calibrating 1, 2, 3, 4 parameters plus the volatility of the loss at default. So we assumed a very simple distribution for loss at default, uniform distribution on 2 points. We fixed the mean at 60%, and we were choosing the volatility in the calibration. And we chose this very simple objective function here that makes sure that we are taking into account the bid-ask spread. And so we have 2, 4, 5 data points here, 0 to 10% tranche, 10 to 15, so on. Here's the index. You see, in order to get protection on the first piece of equity, in order to get protection on the first 10% loss, you have to pay already 67% of the notional. Now, that's pretty expensive to get protection on the first 10%, right? So here's bid and ask, and here's what we get with the model. We are very close with that simple model. It's the simplest model that's out there. We get already quite a good fit. We have very little error. You see the index trades very tightly, very tight bid-ask. We are fitting that within bid-ask. And, this is within bid-ask. The other ones are very close. So there's almost nothing to complain about this fit here. Yeah? Okay, and here's the market-implied loss distribution. If you now take the parameters, stick them into your characteristic function, right? Invert the characteristic function for the distribution and plot the distribution for different horizons. So here's the loss. It's a dollar loss. So we've just normalized the size of the portfolio to be 100. And we have a probability distribution now here on 0, 100. There's no mass here to the right of 70. It's very little mass here, for losses going over 30 or something, right? So here's the peak. And I'm looking at this for several maturities, and we're seeing here, okay, the distribution moves towards the right, so we are shoveling some mass into the right tail of the distribution the farther we go out in the maturity space. So that's sort of the picture of the data translated into a loss distribution. Right? Once you have the loss distribution, you can price any claim on the loss. Yeah? That's the basic philosophy. Actually, I want to talk about some other aspects, as this was intended to be a little bit, an overview of a result. So I'll talk perhaps about some other aspects or some other ways of calculating these sort of things, not Fourier transform based, but maybe using simulation. And that's important, of course, if you're interested in securities that have very complicated payoffs that make it very hard to apply, kind of analytical technology that we have over here. So you would be interested in simulating sequences of arrival times. So how are we going to do this? So here's a very interesting result that has implications and applications beyond simulation. Okay, and here's the result. So it's due to Meyer in 71. It says that if you have a point process with continuous compensator that increases to infinity, then you can represent it, or then you can rescale it, you can transform it into a standard Poisson process and not, and the rescaling is defined by the inverse of its compensator. Okay? So you give me any point process N with continuous compensator that increases to infinity, I look at the inverse of that guy, and I evaluate the process at that new time here. What I'm getting back is a Poisson process with rate 1. Okay, so that gives you immediately already a way of simulating the process. And let's look at the picture. It's maybe more informative. So we have a graph here of the compensator path. It's a sample path of the compensator. It's an increasing process. Here are my arrival times, T1 through T5, and I'm rescaling those arrival times by means of the compensator. I'm getting Poisson arrival times. Yeah? So this sequence here are the arrival times of a standard Poisson process. So now I can turn this thing around and can say, well, look, I can just simulate those arrival times, rescale them according to the compensator, and get back sample points of the process. Yeah? That's one application of the result. Another application that we pursued in another project, and I'll give you the reference later on, is to actually use it the other direction to say, okay, how can we generate new point process models? Well, we can always just start with a standard Poisson process, take any continuous increasing process as a time change, apply it to the standard Poisson, and get a new point process N whose compensator is exactly given by the time change. Okay? So that gives you an enormous tool to generate point process models out of a simple Poisson process by time change. I'm not going to be talking about that. I'll give you a reference later on. I want to talk a little bit about using this for simulation. So, more formally, you would obtain an arrival time almost surely as the inverse the compensator at a Poisson arrival time, so you look at the hitting time of your compensator path to the Poisson arrival time. So that would be a way of simulating, right? You simulate your sample path here, you simulate the first time, you look at the hitting time of your process to that thing, and that hitting time is your first arrival time. And you can do this successively, go to the next, you update your intensity, go to the next piece, hitting time of that one to this boundary here, get the next arrival time. Okay, well, you can, I'm not going through all of that, but you can do that, for example, for the Hox process, where the intensity is really deterministic between arrivals, and you don't have to simulate a Brownian motion path between the arrivals, right? You do want to avoid, if you can, having to simulate the Brownian motion between the arrivals. But if you have a process that has a Brownian motion in between arrivals, such as the one with the square root term, well, you can't avoid that. This procedure here, right? So in other words, the procedure is not very effective as soon as you have Brownian path to simulate, okay? And it's pretty slow. It takes tons of time. So here would be an example, right? You have this process here. This is the intensity here. You want to simulate the jump times here of the process. These are your arrival times. I apologize, it seems to be a little bit small. Okay, so in order to use the time change to generate the point process, you would have to simulate the intensity path. Okay? Then you get the first piece, right? You simulate and cumulative, you know, then you simulate the intensity path, you take the integral of that, you get to this point, you update the intensity, you see it goes up a little bit because of the updating, right? It jumps up. So the compensator continues, but it goes up till the next. But, you know, you really have to simulate this whole path here. So it's very ineffective once you have a Brownian motion floating around there in between events. So I want to propose something, some other interesting method that avoids precisely that. Now, we've been thinking about this in for a little while already, and I just thought I gave you some ideas about that. So it's not completely, you know, developed to its conclusion, but I think we've gotten to a point where I can actually talk about it. So the idea is this. Suppose we are standing, we simulated the kth arrival time. Yeah? So we're fixing the omega, we're sitting there at this arrival time. So the idea would be to choose a dominating intensity. Well, that can depend on omega, right? If I stand here at this omega, depends on the k, such that my intensity between, or my intensity lambda c, is below that bound for all times from now up until the horizon of the simulation, almost surely. And lambda c is my intensity between the arrivals. So in the previous case, it would be just a simple fellow diffusion, simple CIL process. Okay. So now, this is our guy here. This is a sort of defines a dominating process. We're interested in the point process, which is hard to simulate because it has a Brownian part. So we are choosing another point process, which in a sense dominates the one that we're interested in. And we would be simulating from the dominating process and then accept or reject points that we simulated from the dominating process. Okay? So we simulate these candidate arrival times of our dominating Poisson process. Poisson process because this intensity is independent of time. And we accept a candidate point as our next arrival time with a probability that's given by the ratio of the original intensity at that point over the bound that we found. Okay? So therefore, in order to implement that methodology, you only have to simulate, you only have to choose the bound. Given the bound, you simulate a bunch of Poisson arrival times, and each time you check, do you accept or reject the point? You accept it with a probability given by that ratio here. In order to get that ratio, you only need to sample one value of your intensity at the candidate arrival time. You don't need to simulate the whole path anymore. You just need to simulate one point. So it's computationally much more effective to simulate using that machinery rather than using the previous method that uses the time change. Okay? So there is a little caveat here. And maybe I shouldn't go through this. The problem is, if you have a Brownian motion in between events, well, there does not exist a dominating bound because the Brownian motion can always go through, right? So I cannot find, I can choose this bound very high, but there's always a positive, strictly positive probability that I'm going to hit that bound, right? So that probability, or that hitting probability here, is always strictly positive. An example is precisely the kind of guy that we want to simulate, right? That's the guy, has this intensity. So in between, I fix two jump times. In between, it evolves as a CIR process or a fellow diffusion. That's precisely the candidate where we actually cannot find any such process. But what we can do is we can say, well, let's accept a little bit of an error. We choose the lambda k such that probability of hitting stays below some tolerance level. Let's call it epsilon, very small. Okay? And we can choose this, we can do this, because at least in that case here, the hitting time distribution, i.e. that probability here, is known in closed form. That's a result by Linetsky. It's an eigenfunction expansion approach that he pursues. and it gives you the sitting probability here in a computationally convenient form, and then you can use the time change again in order to assess, at least statistically, the accuracy of that simulation procedure. We said we accept some error, right? We said we're choosing some epsilon, and we have a positive probability that's less than epsilon that we violate the bound that we've chosen, right? The higher we are up with the bound, the lower is the probability that we're going to hit it, but the lower is our acceptance probability, so the more inefficient it becomes. So we want to choose the bound as close as possible so that we don't reject all the points, okay? So that's the thing, and we can assess the accuracy using the rescaling result again. Now we're using this as a test. We are saying, well, we can simulate all the points using whatever tolerance level we choose, and we are going to rescale our points using Meyer's result. We are going to rescale our points. We simulated these points, not using the time change, but we simulated them by thinning, and we rescale them with our compensator that we know, and so we obtain these points, and we can just test whether they are Poisson or not. If they are Poisson, then our simulation is accurate, even if we've accepted some margin of error. And a simple way of seeing that would be to look at a QQ plot, right, where you say, well, you plot the empirical quantiles of the standard exponential that it should be of the rescale times versus the theoretical quantiles of the standard exponential. And you see, you choose the error, the tolerance level 10 to the minus 8, you have literally no error in a statistical sense. Simulation is correct, whereas if you choose 0.1 as the error bound, well, then it's too low. The simulation is fast because you're not rejecting too many points, but you're accepting an error here. So the distribution is not correct. It should be standard exponential, but because we are accepting a too low tolerance level, we are going to hit the boundary quite many times, resulting in an error of the simulation. So this is a way of trading off this kind of accepting tolerance and speed, increasing the speed versus accuracy of the simulation, and we can assess this here. This all can be made more formal, but I thought let's make it perhaps less formal. How many minutes do we still have? 5 minutes? Okay, I just have 3 more slides. This idea of thinning is actually very closely related. So it's called thinning because if you go back to what we're doing here, we are accepting a point with a probability that's given by our original intensity over the intensity of the dominating process. It's like saying we have 2-point processes, right? And we generate points from the dominating one, and we are thinning it out. We're taking points out probabilistically, right? And the ratio gives me sort of an expression of, you know, how many points I take out on average, right? So this, I thin out the point process. And we can use very similar ideas to actually allocate, right, the portfolio loss process that we started to model among the single names in my pool. Yeah? Pool of names. Okay? So the way we would do this, why is this useful? Well, as I said at the beginning, well, we need to really do this because we're interested in estimating the sensitivity of the spread of our tranche, of our index, or whatever it is, in response to small changes in the spread of the constituent names. That's the hedging problem. Yeah? So we need to estimate that exposure in order to be able to determine the optimal hedge. Okay? So for any model, we can show that there actually exists a process VI such that the probability of name I defaulting in between time t, time s, given information available at time t, is equal to that right-hand side here, which involves a conditional expectation over that VI guy and the lambda. The lambda was the intensity of our portfolio loss process. What's the idea? Again, slightly more formal. You can think of this in terms of the Rod and Nikodym theorem. You have a portfolio counting process, right, that has a compensator, and that compensator is nothing else than a random measure, right? Now you have also for each individual name I, you have a counting process that just has one jump. Right? It's a firm default, it jumps up to one, stays there. Well, also is a compensator. It's also a random measure, and I can look at the Rod and Nikodym derivative of that latter guy with respect to the former guy. If I do that, then my Zi is precisely that Rod and Nikodym derivative. Right? And using that, we can actually show that the Zi is nothing else than the conditional probability, Zi at time t, is the conditional probability that the kth default is going to be the ith firm, given we have an event at time t. And so here the sum is just picking out the right interval so that we've observed exactly k minus 1 events at time t. And we are saying, what's the probability now that the kth default, given we've seen k minus 1 defaults, the probability of the kth default is actually the ith firm, IBM, Oracle, whatever, right? So that's the interpretation of this thinning process. It's called thinning process because, again, we are thinning out the portfolio level intensity to get the single name intensity. There are some more pitfalls attached to this here. I'm not going to go into this. There are issues of projection and so on, because one has to be careful of the filtrations. These tall eyes are actually not adapted to my filtration, so I have to project down, take optional projections of my counting processes. Let's not go into this, but instead look at this picture where we say, well, my portfolio level intensity is just the Hawkes process, the Hawkes intensity. I start out constant, there is an event, jump up, exponential decay event, jump up, exponential decay. Right? And what I'm doing here is just allocating the pie, splitting up the pie into pieces. This firm, firm 5, gets this much. Firm 4 gets this much. 3 this much. 2 this much. 1 this much. Okay? And how do I choose the size of the piece? Well, I'm choosing it in such a way that I reproduce the single name swap curves that I see in the market. So I'm coming up with a parametric model for my lambda process, specify the portfolio loss process through its intensity, Hawkes process, or with random fluctuation, or some other process. There are more processes than those affine ones. And I'm saying, well, at any time, a particular piece of the action, that intensity, goes to a particular name. And I'm choosing the size of the piece so that I would reproduce with the piece that I've obtained that way the single name swap curves. That's the thinning ideas, and that links up, that allows us to link up the portfolio level process to its constituents. And that in turn, I'm not going to go into this because time is over, allows us to actually estimate the sensitivity of the portfolio derivative mark to market to small change in the spread of any underlying name, right? That in turn gives you the hedge ratio, that gives you the amount of protection you have to buy or sell, the amount of single name CDS you have to buy or sell in order to be approximately neutral to changes in the single name spreads. Yeah, so that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of calculation any investor would like to carry out. Yeah, think again on this example. You have sold somebody else protection on the equity piece, right? The equity is very sensitive to the more riskier names in your pool, right? Because they tend to default first. Because you've sold equity protection, you're going to be hit first. You're going to have to pay out the losses of those risky names. So now imagine that, okay, you entered into that position at some point for spread X, and so that's what you're collecting. And then 10 days later, some firm gets more and more risky, right? Blows up, doesn't really fall, but the spread, you know, doubles up or something. Well, then you realize a mark-to-market loss because where you'd be able to sell protection now, it would be at X plus Y. Y is strictly positive, right? So your position now is worth less than it was at inception, right? And so you realize the mark-to-market loss. And you want to hedge that out, right? That's the hedging problem. So you have to buy the specific amount of protection in the single names, in these risky names, so that upon small changes in the spreads of those single names, you're neutral. You know, your mark-to-market doesn't change. That's the hedging problem. And that we can do with this random thinning machinery. Well, here's some more examples, but let me perhaps just jump to a summary. So what I wanted to emphasize really is that with this point process-based perspective, you can really, you know, you have one set of parameters related to the intensity model that you specified among, you have chosen some model out of a huge class of models, yeah? The parameters of that intensity model really specify the complete distribution of the point process. Therefore, you nail down the complete loss surface, all the call prices for all maturities, for all strikes, completely nailed down. They're parameterized by a low-dimensional set of parameters. Right? You have many data points, and the amount of data is only growing, but you have a process, and you've represented all the data with a handful of parameters. Right? So that's what you have. And so that's good to have. That's not the case with copier models, which are sort of the standard right now in the industry, because there you cannot fit with one set of parameters all the prices. You have to choose with one new price that you're getting, you have to choose an additional parameter, an additional correlation parameter to make the model fit. So with any more data point, you get one more parameter. Well, that's not the kind of thing you would like to have, right? Here you have one model and it captures the complete dynamics and how that loss surface moves forward in time conditionally. This is all captured by the point process. Therefore, we believe it's really a good way to look at things. I haven't talked about forwards and options on indices or tranches. That's something you can do relatively easily in that setup as well. And I've also only talked about, you know, transform-based pricing. There is also simulation. I touched a little bit on that. It's surprisingly sometimes preferable to working with Fourier transforms and having to invert Fourier transforms, to be perfectly honest. Fourier transforms always look good on the paper. You can claim it's analytic, but you know, once you implement it, it gets tough. All right. And so simulation sometimes is easier. It's easier to implement, you get faster results, and you know, it can be used to cross check your Fourier transform based implementation, for example. Yeah? And here are a bunch of papers. I said this was only a smaller selection of some work that we've done over the past 1 or 2 years and that we're still working on. So this thinning, for example, is mathematically described in this paper, the class of affine point processes with various generalizations is in that paper. Also some examples, sensitivities and hedging, etc., is all discussed in here. The time change approach developed in that paper, where I said we start with a simple possible point process model. It's a Poisson process at rate one. We're going to apply a time change, get a new full class of models that we can control. This is described in here. We have another class that's obtained by time changing that turns out to be very, very tractable. So here we are taking a birth process, a simple self-affecting process, right? It has an intensity is constant, there's an event that jumps up, stays constant, there's an event, jumps up, stays constant. We're applying a time change to that, getting a time change birth process, and that effectively leads to closed form prices of tranches, indices, and so on. It's really closed form, so there's no transform inversion involved anymore. The time change really does the trick. It generates rich class of processes from a very simple one, retains tractability. Right now, we are concerned with implementing that thinning. We're experimenting with different ways of setting this up. So there is something to be coming out, I hope, in the next couple of weeks. And I haven't gotten to the point where I write this up with this correlation neutral measure, but I think it's a very interesting way of sort of having an umbrella over all these activities here. Say, okay, these are all just special cases, and I've tried to describe them in that way. They're just special cases of point processes whose characteristic function you can actually calculate under this correlation neutral measure, right? All the other processes, you get them also by different means. Sometimes it's harder to get the characteristic function, but here's some umbrella that I've described that, you know, allows you to look at all these different examples and classes of examples under from one common perspective. And here I end now.